Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, you can go to the events page. You can check out the city events that are happening early next year, early 2020 city events in Vegas and Houston. February 22nd in Houston, Texas. Chad will be there. I'll be there. Loso, Gretchen Ronovich, Scott Keith, Matt Popovitz. We're going to be talking about what happens when people encounter Jesus. Chad's going to have to do some New Testament work. There's no way for him to get out of this. Well, maybe he could. He could talk about like some theophany stuff. Who knows what he's going to do? You got to come check it out. It's free to check it out. So you can register right there. Sign up. There's going to be a lunch. We're going to be hanging out. The city events are always a lot of fun. So February 22nd, if you're in that great state of Texas, we would love to see you there. March 21st, Las Vegas. We're going to be talking about the Book of Galatians, the whole thing. All six chapters, six speakers. I'll be there. Eric Sorensen, Scott Keith, Adam Francisco, Cindy Koch, and Blake Flatley. We're going to be doing Galatians and Sin City. Also free. You can register over at 1517.org. Just go to the events page, click on that event, and sign up. Chad, what's going on, man?
Well, like I was telling you earlier, I'm a little tired. I've been grandparenting for, let's see, since the day before Thanksgiving. That's like 6 days in a row. Yeah. I told my wife that my grandsons are 2 and 6. I told my wife, the first 2 days, you're a grandparent. But anything past that, you've gone back into parent mode.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got it. Yeah, so we've had them for us for several days now, and it's been great. We've done a lot of fun things with them, but they have worn me out.
You think about adopting a couple of 3-year-olds, like maybe triplets or something?
I don't think so. No, I don't think I'm going to. I'm just going to enjoy being a grandparent. The parents get back tonight, so we'll get to pass them back to mom and dad, and Stacy and I can go back to our low-key, quiet lifestyle.
You didn't realize how low-key your lifestyle was until you got some youth injected into that house, did you?
Man, I did not. I mean, I forget. You have no personal space when you have little ones around, and they never, ever, from the moment they get up to the time they go to bed, never, ever stop talking.
Yeah.
Constantly. Yeah. Jabber, 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 jabber. So, but it's been, this is the most time we've had to spend with them, like as far as days in a row goes. So it's been great. But it does remind me I'm knocking on 50's door, and I don't have either the energy or the patience that I had when I was in my 20s.
This is true. This is true. I have this. I mean, I'm knocking on 40's door, and every holiday, on the holidays, you're around all sorts of little kids. I mean, my family's got an insane amount of little kids, but I don't. And I realized as I watched it, I'm like, man, I think I'd just be cleaning up nonstop. Like, I just can't handle this.
Yeah, so, that's pretty much what I've been in the last few days.
People all the time ask me why I only had one kid, and it's not because I hate kids or anything, but my answer is, well, I'm one of six. I already raised like five. And so, like, I'm done.
Yeah. You started parenting sort of early on, right?
Yeah, yeah, man.
Your siblings.
I think one is good for me.
Yeah. I understand completely. Anyway, so here we are in Joshua.
Yeah, man. Joshua 12. It's going to be a break from what we're used to for a little while.
Yeah, it is. We've got, we were looking at this morning, and we've got a lot of chapters coming up that are going to be fairly easy to cover because we've talked about almost everything thematically that these chapters cover in past episodes. I mean, we've got the 2.5 tribes that live east of the Jordan River. We talked about that. We have the division of the land between the 12 tribes. We've talked about that before, at least looking forward to that. And a lot of the other issues we've covered as well. So we're probably going to be shifting into pretty high gear for the next few episodes. And really chapter 12 starts us out here, and it goes all the way through chapter 21. So a big chunk of Joshua. I mean, you kind of picture Joshua is like, oh yeah, it's all this narrative. Well, not really. I mean, yeah, the first 12 chapters, the first 11 chapters, a lot of narrative. Last couple chapters, last three chapters, I guess, narrative again. But there's a pretty good sized chunk, almost 50% of the book. It's not really, I mean, it's got narrative in there, but it's more kind of how they divvy up the land and some of the issues that are involved in that. So we'll cover 12 through 21 at a pretty rapid pace. And then we will be in the wild and wacky R-rated world of Judges, which should be a lot of fun. We'll be there in probably just a handful of episodes.
Yeah, Judges won't be too boring. It might be challenging for you and I, but it won't be boring.
Definitely will not be boring. Yeah, Judges is a lot of things. Boring, it is not. All right, so we didn't finish up chapter 11 last time. Actually, this is one of those cases where I think they got the chapter division wrong. Chapter 12 really should have started at verse 16 of chapter 11, but we'll forgive them that once more. So we finished up chapter 11 last time. That was where we had a summary of the conquered territory. Now, 12 is a relatively short chapter. There's 24 verses. It's easy to divide. You got two main sections. The first is verses 1 through 6. Verses 1 through 6 is a recap of the kings and their territories that were conquered not by Joshua, but really by Moses. So this is a looking back. So this is the reflections upon when Og was defeated by Moses and Israel, and Sihon was defeated by Moses and by Israel, and we have a description in those verses, those first six verses, of the division of those particular territories to the two and a half tribes, to the Reubenites and the Gadites, into the half tribe of Manasseh. You'll remember that those two and a half tribes, they wanted to basically stay east of the Jordan because they had a lot of pasture land there for their animals, and they kind of worked out a deal, I guess you could say, where it wasn't an ideal situation, but they kind of worked out this compromise where Moses said, okay, we will let you have that territory east of the Jordan as yours on one condition, that you come over the Jordan with us and help us to conquer the Holy Land itself, the land that God has promised to give to us. And that's what the two and a half tribes did. They left some people behind to kind of take care of the livestock and watch over the land, but their soldiers all went with the Israelites and helped to conquer all the territory that we've been reading about these first 11 chapters. So that's the first half of chapter 12 of Joshua. Now we pick up with verse 7 all the way through the end of the chapter, and we have a description here. It's more or less a list. Most of these verses are just a listing of the 31 kings that were conquered by Joshua. So if the first six verses are a description of the victories of Moses east of the Jordan, then the last verses are a description of the victories of Joshua west of the Jordan. And that's the way it starts out. Verse 7, now these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated beyond the Jordan toward the west. So from the Jordan River all the way to the Mediterranean. So then it gives them a list of beginning there with the ninth verse. Starts with the king of Jericho, and then it works its way all the way down to verse 24 to the king of Tirzah. One in all, it says 31 kings. Now, I do want to mention one of these kings in particular, just because I find it fascinating. And some of you might know this, but I'm betting a number of you will not realize a connection that we have here. So in, let me find the verse here, verse 21, we have mention of two kings, the king of Ta'anak and the king of Megiddo. Now, Megiddo is a fascinating, the city itself of Megiddo has a fascinating history. And I will use that just as an illustration of how significant it is to read the Old Testament and the New Testament together, to read one in light of the other. We've seen this, of course, time and time again throughout the podcast, but this is one more example of that. And this example is going to help us to understand the interpretation of a specific chapter and verse in the book of Revelation. And you all know it. I'm just not going to tell it to you yet. I'm going to save it for the end of this little discussion. So, Megiddo, what do we know about the city of Megiddo? One of the things we know is that it's an old, old city. There have been archaeological digs going on for almost the last century at the city of Megiddo. It was there from the Neolithic period all the way to the Hellenistic period, so a big span of time. It was there for a long time before Joshua and the Israelites came along. And we also know that it was a city that if it was known for anything, it was known for its wars and its battles. It has like a scarred past, you could say. I think they've uncovered 20 or 21 archaeological layers at the city. So that's like the city's destroyed. Okay, they rebuild it. That's another layer. Then that city is destroyed. So they rebuild it again. That's another layer. And on the city builds up over time. And the reason there were so many battles there is because it was located at a strategic point. So there was an old sort of superhighway, I guess is what we would call it, called the Via Maris, which is the way of the sea. And this went up from Egypt along the Mediterranean all the way up into Mesopotamia. So this ancient roadway, this old superhighway was the way that the Egyptians would go into Mesopotamia and the Mesopotamians would go down into Egypt because, of course, you had trade going back and forth. And Megiddo was located at a very significant point there where there was only a narrow passage in this particular area, and that's where the city Megiddo was. So we have archaeological evidence from an Egyptian temple that talks about a battle that took place between the Egyptians and the Canaanites that happened in the city of Megiddo. We know that Joshua captured the city of Megiddo. We know that Solomon fortified the city of Megiddo. And we also know that several battles took place just from the scriptures themselves. We know from some extra biblical resources of other battles, but we know of a lot of battles just from the Bible itself that took place at Megiddo. So Megiddo, old city, became part of the Israelite cities, and battle after battle after battle took place there. Now, how does this help us to understand exactly this connection between the Old and the New Testament? Well, we've all heard of a particular battle that is talked about in the book of Revelation, chapter 16, verse 16, that is like the end time battle, right? This is going to be the big battle in which Christ is finally going to defeat all the forces of evil. And this is the battle that we all know as Armageddon. Isn't there there's like a movie Armageddon, right?
I was just about to say, I think that you're confusing the Bible with a giant meteor that Bruce Willis
has planned
nuclear warhead in. But
yeah, I was having trouble. I should have looked at that before the podcast. But yeah, that was the movie. So Armageddon. So when we hear Armageddon, we think, yeah, some like huge cataclysmic battle or event, right? That's kind of what we associate it with.
Yeah, well, it is interesting that, I mean, Armageddon is obviously a biblical word. I mean, this is where it comes from. But it's a word that has somehow found its way even out of the Bible into just broad culture, that you could literally name a movie, Armageddon, and just about everyone would understand that this is an apocalyptic film. This is about the last thing, you know. That is interesting. So you don't even have to be a Christian to understand sort of what's baked into the cake of the word Armageddon.
Yeah. So the fascinating part of this is, so Armageddon is a Greek transliteration, meaning they just like took over the sounds from one language and wrote it into another language. So it's a Hebrew word or Hebrew two words that are written in Greek. And the two Hebrew words are Har Megiddo. Har means mountain, and Megiddo, of course, is a reference to the city. So Har Megiddo, Mount Megiddo, comes into Greek as Armageddon. So Har Megiddo, Armageddon. And that is the Old Testament background of Armageddon. So when you read in Revelation chapter 16 about this battle of Armageddon, you're really reading about the battle of Har Megiddo, connected with this ancient city of Megiddo that is mentioned now for the first time in the Bible. It's going to be mentioned several other times, but this is the first mention of it in Joshua chapter 12, in this list of 31 kings that that Joshua conquered. So what's amazing to me, so you trace this, you have this reference to a king of Megiddo conquered by Joshua. Then you have the city Megiddo mentioned multiple times in the Bible and elsewhere. That eventually finds its way into this apocalypse of St. John as this, you know, cataclysmic end-time battle known as Armageddon. And then it works its way into Hollywood, into movies that we make today. So anyway, that's a whole background to what Armageddon is. But it's an important moment to accent what we've accented time and time again, that unless you know kind of this Old Testament background, you're not going to understand a New Testament reference. So the Old Testament background is this whole long war, complicated history of this particular city. And that's why this last cataclysmic battle is called Armageddon, because this place was a place of battles. It was a place where there were a lot of major battles fought throughout history. And so it becomes sort of a metaphor for this last greatest battle that's going to take place at Armageddon.
What's interesting about Armageddon is that even within Christian culture, there's a lot of like fear associated with it, right? Like you think about Armageddon and you're like, oh, that's going to be terrible. When biblically, like Armageddon is like the last battle, right? This is where it's going to be like, it's the best. It's like the last thing that happens before everything, it gets good. It's weird how we do this with things. We have like somehow turned the second coming into a source of anxiety, right? And yeah. So, I mean, I remember this. I mean, I remember watching that old movie from the 70s, A Thief in the Night, and just being completely freaked out about what was going to happen. And then you have the Left Behind series and everyone's freaked out about it. And if you're a Christian, there's nothing scary about the return of Christ. We're supposed to be anticipating it, not dreading it.
Yeah, we look forward to it, right? Yeah, we had a reading in church a couple weeks ago. I think it was from Luke, where it's like when you see all these things happening, he doesn't say run and hide in a cave and put your head between your knees. He's like, lift up your heads because your redemption draws nigh. It's like, this is good news.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like we're entering a battle and we don't know. I mean, we might win, we might lose. I mean, Jesus might be victorious, or Jesus might get, you know, he might get beaten. We don't know. Well, no, of course we know. We already know the end of the story. So maybe because I didn't come from kind of the Left Behind theology background, but the end time for me is like, that's good news. It's not anything to be scared about. It's like, this is great. You know, everything sad is going to come untrue, like Tolkien says. So look forward to it. Don't fear it.
I think it's actually rooted more in a lack of assurance of if we're really in.
I can see that too.
Yeah, I think the fear is mostly, I don't want Jesus to return, because what if I'm not good enough?
What if among the goats and not the sheep, right?
Yeah. I think this is what it really is that you confuse faith with faithfulness, and you wonder if on that day you're going to be found faithful, and if this is the criteria that you're working with, you have a lot of reason for anxiety, because if you think the criteria is faithfulness, not faith, then yeah, we all have reason to be quite afraid, you know? It's the old, I remember this distinctly growing up, you know, you would be wondering, like, before you did something, like, would I want to be doing this thing when Jesus comes back? Like he's going to catch you in the act.
Yeah, you know? I remember those anxieties too.
Yeah. You know, so you always want to be like about your father's business. You don't want to be doing something. And I don't mean like bad things. I don't mean like, do I want to be robbing this liquor store when Jesus comes back? I don't mean that. I mean, just like, do I want to be watching,
binging Netflix?
Yeah, yes, exactly. Do I want to be watching Dumb and Dumber when Jesus comes back? Because I mean, I'm sure that that wouldn't be a very faithful thing to do. And it's just, yeah, it's just simple things like that, or just dreading, you know, having all this anxiety depending on how you view the end times. You know, like, I just don't think I'm gonna be able to hold up.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. I'm gonna straight up apostatize. You know, like when they start pulling out my fingernails, it's gonna be all over for me. And this is just not how the Bible talks about it.
No, no, not at all. I mean, the way the Bible talks about it is the way that Joshua talks about it, right? Before they even cross the Jordan, God says, "All right, I'm giving you this land." It's not right. Like if you are able to actually beat all of these superior armies, then you'll have the land. No, God's like, before you even cross the Jordan, he's like, "Oh yeah, yeah, the land's yours. I'm giving it to you. I'm gonna fight for you." And so it's just like this with the return of Christ.
Well, this is something you see, actually, if you want to know a picture that's being painted in the conquest of the Promised Land, is that, I mean, the Promised Land is, you know, simply a picture of a new heavens and new earth. I mean, like, there's a lot of things going on in the Promised Land. Obviously, it's a land that a promise comes out of, but what comes out of the Promised Land is someone who says, I'm going to make all things new.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a greater Promised Land coming, which is all of creation restored. But look at how God gives them the Promised Land. It's not as though this is ever, I mean, it's, it, I mean, he just gives them victory after victory after victory. It doesn't, I mean, it's so, and you see that the victories are so complete.
Yeah.
And this is how we are to view the second coming, that like when the second coming happens, that this is not going to be some kind of struggle. That he's just going to come and he's going to make all things new. And that's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's tremendous comfort in the monergistic side of this, right? Monergistic, God alone doing the work. I mean, he's the one giving the victory. He's the one that's going to bring about the victory for Joshua, bring about the victory at the end. I mean, really, when Christ comes again, it's not like there's going to be a battle that decides whether he's going to win or not. The victory's already being accomplished. It happened when he rose from the grave.
Yeah.
That was it. So the victory's already occurred. It's just waiting for its full revelation.
Yeah, it's funny. If you look at the finality of all, there's no close battles in the conquest of Canaan, right? Like, there's no close battles. It's resounding victories or just utter defeats. So when they are believing God, it's just victory after victory. I mean, you don't even know if they're losing any guys in these things, right?
Yeah.
And then the second they step out on their own, it's not a close battle either. It's like just completely wiped out. So it is with the second advent, right? It's going to be definitive. It's not going to be like, whew, it's a close one.
Yeah, yeah. Barely made it. Just squeaked out into the victory.
There's no close ones in the Bible, man. There's no, these battles are not close.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's chapter 12, right?
That's it.
Little Armageddon. Now you know a little bit more about Armageddon. So Joshua, you might never realized that Joshua is a good commentary on Revelation, but now you know.
Yeah, no one expected us to go to Armageddon and the second coming today.
We caught him
full of surprises.
Yeah, we're full of surprises. Okay, so let's jump to the next chapter here, chapter 13. We're told Joshua is getting up in years. That's the way this chapter starts out. Joshua's old, advanced in years. It doesn't tell us here. He's probably 80, 85, something like that. And this sounds strange to us, but this is just typical Hebrew here, the way this sounds. Let me just read the verse to you. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years when the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years." It sounds strange to us as English speakers to hear that, but that is, that kind of repetition is just kind of typical of the Hebrew way of.
God is not above stating the obvious.
He did, and or repeating himself. He God is all about repetition. So you're old in events and years, he says, and very much of the land remains to be possessed. So they've made great strides, and they've conquered, as we saw in the last chapter, 31 kings, a lot of territory, but there's still work to be done. And then it goes on to say where this work is. So this is the land that remains, all the regions of the Philistines and all those of the Geshurites. And then it kind of spells out who the kings of the Philistines are and what particular cities and territories still need to be conquered. Now, I think it's insightful if you read those opening verses in Joshua chapter 13 in connection with what we read in Judges chapter 3. So listen to these four verses from Judges chapter 3, because this is going to echo what we read in the opening of Joshua 13. So Joshua 13 describes the land of the Philistines as remaining unconquered. Now we get to Judges chapter 3, and it says, "Now these are the nations which the Lord left to test Israel by them, that is, all who had not experienced any of the wars of Canaan, only in order that the generations of the sons of Israel might be taught war, those who had not experienced it formerly." And then it goes on to say that the nations were the five lords of the Philistines and the Canaanites and the Sidonians and the Hivites who lived in Mount Lebanon, etc. And verse 4, "And they were for testing Israel to find out if they would obey the commandments of the Lord, which he had commanded their fathers through Moses." Now, the reason I think it's interesting to read Judges 3, those opening verses, in connection with Joshua 13, is Judges gives you a little bit more of an explanation as to what's going on here on the side of God. So Joshua just says, these lands remain to be conquered, or these territories remain to be conquered. But Judges says, okay, one of the reasons that God is providentially working things out this way is twofold. One, it's a test for Israel to see whether they would obey the commands that he gave them through Moses. And secondly, it's also that by leaving these nations, he is teaching the Israelites how to conduct themselves in warfare. The reason I think this is insightful is because it shows that God wants to make sure that his people, even as he's giving them this gift, he's given them also something against which they can struggle. So he's not like removing completely from them every testing situation. He's not removing them completely from every hardship or every struggle that they have to face, because he knows that they need it. And I think that Judges 3 is insightful, not just for understanding Joshua, but for understanding our situation as well. I mean, This is the situation that we call it the church militant, right? Because we are engaged in ongoing warfare. And sure, I mean, God, I suppose, could remove every obstacle that we face. He could remove every struggle that we face. He could pull out every single thorn in the flesh that's bothering us, but he doesn't do that. He doesn't do it for us for the same reason he didn't do it for the Israelites, because he knows that in this life, we are engaged in constant warfare, and he's kind of using these struggles that we face as a way of reminding us over and over and over again, this is more of his repetition, that when we are weak, when we're struggling with our own weakness because of the obstacles that we face, that he himself is our strength, that he's the one who is fighting for us.
The promised land is not about giving you a land free from the fall.
Yeah, it's not a new Eden.
No.
Not a paradise, in other words.
No, it's a good land. I mean, like we hear this, right? It's a good land. It's a good place for him to be. It's a land that he has made promises about, and he has promised the Messiah to come out of it. who will restore all things. But there is, you shouldn't read that I'm going to give you this land and it's going to be flowing with milk and honey and stuff, and kind of read it as this: I'm going to give you a land free of suffering, free of turmoil, free of death. None of this is true. And we see this. I mean, it's interesting that the promised land, there might not be a land full of more bloodshed in the world than this land. I mean, like, just throughout its history, even after it's, I mean, Israel will be displaced, they'll go back, they'll be displaced again, they'll be conquested by, you know, they'll be taken over by Rome, there's constant turmoil. I mean, there's nothing there's nothing in the history of the land occupied by Israel it's not only all peace and harmony, it's the exact opposite of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few very, very brief epochs in Israel's history, like in Solomon's reign, where it's relatively peaceful. But those are, the exception proves the rule in those cases.
Yeah.
Most of the time, there's enemies either within or without. And it sits at the crossroads of the great nations of the world who are constantly trying to control it because it's the way that they get from one to the other. So you have ongoing conflict there, and this was God's way of training his people. He was using this land as a training ground for them, because he was ultimately, all of this is making sure that when it's time for the Messiah to come, that he has a people who are there, that this becomes a land out of which the Messiah himself will be born. And well, the idea of God was for then the Messiah to come to Israel, and then for Israel and the Messiah to move out from there and to take the kingdom of God to the ends of the earth. And I mean, that happened, at least maybe not according to the way that it was pictured in some cases in the Old Testament. But you did have the representatives of the new Israel. You had the disciples of the Lord, and they took the message of the Messiah to as far as they went, and then it went from there, and you have the expansion of the kingdom of God. So you do have this image in the Old Testament of the nations coming to Israel, but you also have this image of the Israelites, the sons of Abraham, taking the blessings of Abraham outward. So you kind of have an inward focus in the sense that the people are coming to Israel, but you also have an outward focus where Israel is going out to the nations. So this all goes back to Genesis chapter 12, where God promises that through Abraham, he will bless all of the nations. So in a sense, the Messiah gathers all to himself in Israel, and then through the message that his sent ones take out to the nations, and he takes this blessing of Abraham out to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, when we hear that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, even when it appears that we are wrestling against flesh and blood, you have to believe that this is true for Israel, who it appears is constantly wrestling against flesh and blood. But the devil himself is not exactly keen on the promises of God and wars against them. And so Israel is going to be in almost constant conflict, if for no other reason. The devil knows what's going on here, and he's all about destroying this promise. You can know that you're fighting a losing war, but still say, yeah, I'm going to make the whole thing miserable.
Yeah. So we see that misery reflected in the life of Israel, and of course we see that ongoing conflict within the kingdom still today. Even though he knows he's on the losing side. Okay, that's the first seven verses. The rest of the chapter is kind of a summary of what we talked about, I think back in Numbers 21, I believe is when it was. So this is the description of the land that's given to the 2.5 tribes on the eastern side of the Jordan. So the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half tribes of Manasseh. And it's a description basically of which lands and which cities were given to them to dwell in. We do have one interesting verse that talks about the tribe of Levi. And this comes up, I think, four times in the book of Joshua, the inheritance that was given to the sons of Levi. you remember that when Joshua was, and when Moses before him was kind of spelling out who was going to inherit what, that the Levite, the tribe of the Levites, were not given a territory. They were given cities in which they could live with the pasture lands that were around those cities, but they weren't given like a geographical territory as their own. Instead, they were spread out throughout the land of Israel. And so we have a reference to that in verse 14. It says, only to the tribe of Levi he did not give an inheritance. The offerings by fire to the Lord, the God of Israel, are their inheritance, as he spoke to them. So what's fascinating to me, at least, is that in these four references to the inheritance of the tribe of Levi, you have different things highlighted every time. I mean, they're all facets of the one inheritance, but different things are highlighted every time. So verse 14 says, what's their inheritance? Well, the offerings by fire to the Lord, that is their inheritance. But if you go to the very last verse of this chapter, it says, verse 33, it says, to the tribe of Levi, Moses did not give an inheritance. The Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance. So the first verse says the offerings are their inheritance. The second verse says that the Lord, the God of Israel, is their inheritance. And then when we get to chapter 18, we're told that the priesthood is their inheritance. So, of course, all of these are just, as I say, different facets of the same inheritance. The point being that they're not going to inherit land. Instead, God is their inheritance. That is, God and his gifts, like the offerings by fire, or God and his priesthood that offers these sacrifices, are their inheritance. The point is all the same, that for the Levites, their inheritance were these things of God, the ministry, the offerings, God himself. He was the one who was their inheritance, because that was to be the focus of what they were all about. That was their vocation in Israel, to serve as his priest, to be those who speak his word, to be those who offer his sacrifices. So they, among all the tribes, did not get this specific area of land as their own.
Yeah, in a real way, the promises of God, certainly the priesthood, sort of the stewards of the mystery of God, and they're to steward the promises of God and the things that point forward to the coming of Christ. This is what they have inherited, that they are going to steward those things.
Yeah, and in that way, they portray for us beforehand, and I think what's a very helpful way of the ministry of Christ, because he comes as the one who is a new kind of priest, and he's the one who then offers himself. He is the mystery of mysteries, and then he becomes the one who gives us the inheritance of the kingdom of God, the inheritance of his own sacrifice, and the inheritance of those who now share in his own priesthood as those who are baptized into him and who offer to him a sacrifice of thanksgiving, and then who turn around and bring that sacrifice, bring that gospel out to those who are around us, just like the Levites of old brought the gifts of God out to those whom they served.
Amen. And that's it, man. We accomplished two chapters today. So
we did.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Not
See what
bad.
We can do next time.
Absolutely. Guys, if the podcast has been helpful to you, it is the end of the year, and we could use your help. So if you would like to support it, you can go over to 1517.org/donate, or just go over to 1517.org and you'll see the donate button, and you can become a contributor. You can help hold the rope. Thank you so much to those of you who do that. You make all of this possible. And Chad, we will see you next week.
We'll see you here.